baie welkom by vanoggend se gesprek. Ek is werklik bevoorreg en voel baie, ja, dis my besondere groot eer om met regter Albie Sachs te gesels. By hierdie geleentheid wat aangebied word deur die Vriende vir Afrikaans. En dit is 'n gesprek oor Afrikaans. En dit is 'n gesprek oor die toekoms van Afrikaans en dis hoekom ek die jong geleedere gevra het om 'n bietjie vorentoe te sit, want ek wat miskien generasie voor julle is en van die gehoor wat 'n bietjie agter sit wat dalk 2 of 3 generasies voor julle is, is baie geïnteresseerd in jong mense se opinie oor Afrikaans. Ons as woordfees is tuis in 'n universiteitsdorp waar die kompleksiteite rondom taal en onderrig en moedertaalonderrig en die bevoordeling en bevoorregting van Afrikaans voortdurend onder skoot kom. En na jare se gestry en gebeklei nog geen duidelikheid oor wat die beste vir Afrikaans is of wat die beste vir die universiteit is nie. Daar is maar net nie eenstemmigheid oor dit nie. En ek dink dit is goed, want dit gee vir die taal 'n bietjie energie. Wanneer Afrikaans onder druk is, floreer dit. Ek weet nie of julle dit weet nie, maar ons kaartjie verkoop bewys dit, dat ons het 'n ongekende bywoningssyfer in Afrikaanse toneel en Afrikaanse boekgesprekke. Dit is die hoogste wat dit nog ooit was. Baie interessante tendens waar musiek oor die algemeen baie goed vaar by kunstefeeste soos die Woordfees, is dit vanjaar loshande die jaar van die toneel. En ons kan later praat oor wat dit sê, dit maak my baie opgewonde. Maar ons is nou nie vandag hier om oor die fees te praat nie, ons sit hier aan die voete van 'n groot gees wat baie diep spore getrap het in Suid-Afrika se bevrydingsstryd en 'n soort politieke gewete vir Suid-Afrika is wat min mense so konsekwent oor so lang tydperk bly handhaaf het. Iemand met onkreekbare integriteit. Ons gaan vandag praat oor 'n hofuitspraak wat reeds in 1996 in die jare wat Albie 'n regter was aan die konstitusionele hof. Hy was regter in die konstitusionele hof toe daar 'n dispuut was oor die onderwys wet of skoolonderwyswet was en wat die verskil is wat in 1996 die geval is en waar dit nou is. So ek gaan vir hom vra om 'n kort inleiding te gee. En ek wil ook reeds in hierdie stadium noem, ek het die boek nog nie gelees nie, ek het hom pas ontvang, maar na afloop van die gesprek is hierdie pragtige boek te koop. Ek het dit nie self gelees nie, maar ek weet mense wat dit gelees het, het gesê dis waarskynlik een van die belangrikste historiese dokumente of persoonlike historiese dokumente wat handel oor Suid-Afrika en die afgelope paar dekades en wat hier gebeur het. So koop die boek, lees die boek, maar kom ons luister eers na regter Sachs. Vir die doeleindes van die gesprek, dit gaan hoofsaaklik in Afrikaans wees. Soos julle almal weet, is regter Sachs Engelssprekend, so hy gaan in Engels antwoord, maar julle is welkom om die vrae in Afrikaans te vra en ons openbaar 'n oggend van taalsoepelheid en hoe ons soemloos tussen die tale om met mekaar omgaan. En solank ons dan net ordentlike gesprek het, maak nie saak in watter taal jy praat nie. Kom ons luister na mekaar. So kom ons luister eers na die groot gees.
Laat die fees begin. Let me start. And I wonder if any of you saw the film 4 Weddings and a Funeral. I'm going to give you 4 surprises and a solution. And to have a solution, you need a problem, so I'll start with the problem. And the problem is the case that we heard now in my capacity as rechter. No, nie die rechter nie. Ek is Albie. Today I'm Albie. But imagine now I'm wearing my gown, I'm sitting in the Constitutional Court in Johannesburg, and a case is being brought to us by a number of taalgroepe, Afrikaans, defense of Afrikaans groups, about a law which the Gauteng legislature had passed called the Gauteng Education Act. And one of the provisions, education bill it was at that stage, said that no one shall be refused attendance at a school on the grounds of his or her language. And that was understood by the Afrikaans Taalgroepe as being aimed at the Afrikaans medium state schools that were turning away children, basically black children, who didn't speak Afrikaans. And the children were saying, we have a right to go to school, and the school was saying, we have a right to defend and protect and develop the Afrikaans language. And we had to decide, was that law unconstitutional as a denial of language rights? So that was the problem. Now let me give you some of the surprises, and I'll be surprised if my surprises don't surprise you. The first one was my involvement at Kempton Park at CODESA, Convention for Democratic South Africa, on the language question. And there were two of us from the ANC side. It was Baleka Mbete, then known as Khosetsila. She was married to the poet Willie Khosetsila. And a huge range of professors. And Neil Barnard, who was head of national intelligence on the other side. In physical terms, it was really like David and Goliath, and we were the David. And there was extreme tension and anxiety on the National Party government side, because if Afrikaans was seen to be being sold down the river, then the whole project would be destroyed in the eyes of Afrikaans-speaking, white Afrikaans speakers. So this was a make or break issue for the other side. Baleka and I came in very smiling, very confident, because we knew that there was a fair solution. And it was clear to us that what the other side, then we used to say the enemy, it's interesting, that was fairly early on, then it was the enemy. As the negotiations advanced, we would say the regime. And then as people like Rolf May and the others came to the fore, we would say the other side. So even the language softened as we made progress. This was now between the enemy and the regime. Great tension. And there were all these language experts from different universities, plus the head of intelligence on their side. And Baleka and I had both had very important experience in Africa. Baleka had been in Tanzania, the University of Dar es Salaam. And at first, the approach of newly independent Tanzania was English. But the people spoke Swahili, Kiswahili. And the idea that you had to use the language of the former colonizing power as the language of the nation for status, for business, for law, for everything, was anathema to the people, but they fought about it, and they decided, no, we want the language spoken by the people themselves, Kiswahili as well as English, as official languages. I'd been in Mozambique, and it was very inspiring for people like me, back in Africa, on African soil, dealing with African problems. And Samora Machel was an extremely charismatic figure. And he had a very powerful slogan, for the nation to live, the tribe must die. And we were inspired by that. And he said, we must do everything on the basis of non-tribalism. We must destroy tribalism. So if he appointed a governor to Makonde province in the north, he would send a Shangaan speaker to emphasize. And we thought that was fantastic. And we learned it was a mistake. Portuguese, he said, was the language of national unity. We had taken Portuguese from the oppressors. We had turned it into the instrument of freedom. Viva, long live. A luta continua, the struggle continues. That's Portuguese language to unite black Mozambicans and white Mozambicans who supported their cause. So that would be the language of national unity, the language of government, to bring all the people together. It sounded inspiring. It was a mistake. We learned it was a mistake. People are close to their languages. Tribalism must die, but not the culture of the different ethnic communities. We just learned that was important, that all languages matter. And we had debates about that in Mozambique. And when the ANC had a little conference on the future of languages in South Africa, we decided on the formula that there are 11 languages that are deeply rooted in the texture of our society. English, Afrikaans, and 9 indigenous African languages. And they all must have the same status, parity of esteem. And in order to achieve that, you don't achieve that by downgrading any of the official languages. You achieve that by upgrading the languages that have been marginalized. So we introduced the notion of non-diminution of the status of existing languages. This is now in the 1990s, and upgrading of languages that were marginalized. So the temptation was to say 1 plus 10, English plus 10 others. That would have meant for Afrikaners being seen as, sadly, racist factors would have come in to say we don't want to be with the Bantu languages. That was unacceptable. But understandably, would be seen as saying that English is superior to Afrikaans. And it would have revived all the memories of Milner and the suppression of the Afrikaans language and the marginalization. And we took that position not to be nice to anybody. It's nice to be nice. There's nothing wrong about being nice. You don't apologize for being nice. But that wasn't the motive. That was a plus. It was a matter of principle. Languages are important to people. You respect languages. They identify in terms of languages. A lot of their history is wrapped up with language and autonomy and expression in terms of their language. And we did that wholeheartedly. So instead of there being a crisis, the only crisis was understanding the word non-diminution. It's not found in many constitutions. What did that actually mean? So that's surprise number one. And I can see from your eyes that you are at least a little bit surprised. I might mention as well that we introduced, and I pushed very hard for this, the notion of the Pan-South African Language Board. Not each language represented on a board fighting for itself. We had to get away from the fact that for Afrikaans to win, isiZulu must be demoted, or English must be kept in its place, or also counts for less. You don't view language as competing with fighting against other languages. You see that the multilingualism is the basic approach, and we wanted the Pan-South African Language Board, not the South African Languages Board, to operate. And I think it's good that we've achieved that. Not that the Pan-SALB is functioning as well as it could, but I think that was a correct approach that we had. We joked, we called it the PSLB board, because I was really the author of it, Pan-South African Language Board, PSLB board. Second surprise, I'm busy writing the judgment in the same-sex marriages case, Fourie. This is 2005, I think. My phone rings and a voice says, Albie, it's Big Butter here. I believe you've got an English translation of the poem Dis Al. Can I have it, please? Now, I'm extremely intensely busy, and the Fourie case was not difficult in terms of establishing equality for gay and lesbian same-sex marriages. But should Parliament be involved, what the order of the court should be? That was quite tricky. I'm concentrating on that. And Pik Buerta comes in like this, crashing in. But I was intrigued and amused that he should be asking me for a translation of Dis Al. Now, do you all know Dis Al here? Even in the front row? Not everybody, yeah? Amal Al. almost, this album. 1990, I'm back from 24 years of exile. I'm at a conference in Bloemfontein. There are a couple of hours to spare, and some urge grabs me. And I say, can you take me to De Vroo Monument? And I'm driven there. And I find myself deeply moved. Now, this is the memorial established outside Bloemfontein, basically to the Boer women and children who died in the concentration camps during the time of the Anglo-Boer War. And it's got a statue there, and it's in Dutch. And I ask, what does it mean? I think it says, ons sal nie vergeet nie, ons sal nie vergewe nie. But the person translated said, we won't forget, but we will forgive. But it didn't say that. I think it said we won't forgive. But what moved me was it was a very authentic memorial. And there were some pavilions there that had little things carved by the Boer prisoners of war in Ceylon and Bermuda and elsewhere, which they'd kept and brought back, and letters that they'd sent to their folks. And it was so like our people, being locked up on Robben Island and in Pretoria, and they'd carved things, and they'd made a saxophone out of seaweed, and they'd written their letters. And I just had that overwhelming feeling of how people can oppress people and how injustice can pass through the generations. I later went to the Voortrekker Monument, and it didn't have that effect on me at all. This was a monument to power. It wasn't a monument to suffering. But I bought a copy of a poem which showed a Boer Vryheidsvechter who had come back from exile, a Bunneling. Now, I'd come back from exile, a Bunneling. And he has his hat off, and the land is flat. There's a little bit of smoke in the background. There's nothing. He's come back to his farm, and there's nothing. Dis al. Dis die blond, dis die blauw. And so many of our people now were coming back. My friend, his name will come back to me in a minute, came back to his house in Pretoria, African guy. There was nothing there. It was gone. He'd been in exile for a long time. And I had that same feeling now reading this poem about our generation living through an experience so similar. And it had the poem Dis al. And I kept it in my chambers together with other pictures that I'd bought. And at the beginning of the negotiations, there was one Afrikaans-speaking judge and one English-speaking judge asked to preside at Kodesa. It was Judge Skabot and Ismail Mohammed. And Skabot came into my chambers. He was amazed to see that poem there. And I decided I would translate it into English. And I translated it, and somehow the word got years later, 10 years later, to Pukbuerta. So I interrupted writing the judgment, and I sat down, and I still remember I had a trouble with the first line, Dis die blond, dis die blauw. And I translated it as, it's the white, it's the blue. But that lost the bleu. And so now I was able to say, it's the blanched, it's the blue, which was better, more responsive. And I phoned Pukbuerta afterwards, and I emailed a copy to him. But I mention that just to say that pain is pain. And we are living in the epoch of continuing black pain. I think the student movement, by and large, has made a huge contribution to national discourse and sensibility through raising the issue of continued forms of marginalization, alienation, that's not in the law, that's not there in formal terms. It's not overt, but it's covert. And sometimes it's more insidious precisely because it's covert. It's not acknowledged. It's not even appreciated that these things have an impact on you. But that goes two ways. It goes, well, one way is to say those of us who are white, who are privileged, who take the world that we inhabited, that was constructed in our image as a world taken for granted, as the natural, normal world, the way societies go, can be suffocating and exclusionary. Just as when I was reading the book by Die Sestiger, Jan Rabi, he starts off by saying, "Ons die afgod," and this guy is walking up in a Ronjezucht, and he's feeling very alien as an Afrikaner. And now I couldn't imagine a Ronjezucht, you can't have a more Dutch name than that, and I didn't see it as that a place where an Afrikaner could feel unwelcome. But that's that hidden kind of signals that come from architecture, from signs, from symbols, from street names, from assumptions that can be so impactful. So it's important then for white people, privileged people, to be responsive to that. But it's also important for people who are privileged to understand something in the history of Afrikaners, that there was deep Afrikaner pain, using that the image of pain, the language of pain, that was very pronounced and very deep. Sadly, the pain converted itself amongst many into retaliation and marginalization and exclusion. But that didn't deny the fact that there was enormous dispossession of Afrikaners. And I felt quite moved when at school we had to learn Afrikaans. It was compulsory and we didn't like it. I'm at English-speaking school, Sachs. We had that disdain for the Afrikaans and it was forced upon us. And the only books we were given to read were books about animals, because the other books were all patriotic and nationalist. So we learnt about the lion family, at Urwet in Vlakte. We learnt about the wit mire, the white ants. We learnt about Kias van die Kalahari. And we weren't interested in books about animals. We wanted boxers and fighter plane pilots and explorers and so on. So that became part of our disdain. When I was in exile in England, I remember those books. And I picked up on the fact that people are writing about the Urwet because they feel their country has been conquered. They feel they are not fully welcome in their own, on their own land, indirectly. And I loved these books that I'd hated when at school. So that's the second surprise. The third surprise is, not long after I'm back, I'm speaking at a language conference and I'm invited to come to Stellenbosch to see the progress of Die Woorde book. And it was up to M. And they're very proud they're up to M. And about 10 years later, I come back again and I think they're up to R. Now, what is it up to now? Does anybody know?
S.
Of S. So maybe I'll live to see Z. But it was kind of moving for me. This is an investment in time and so on. In a way, the language can't be captured in a book. It's changing. Even while the book's being, I'm sure there are lots of words now beginning with A, B, C, D, E, and so on. Completely new words, and old words have new meanings. But there is something moving, just about this idea to anchor a language in some official kind of a text. It shows an appreciation and a love and a respect. People are working very hard on that, and I'm moved, and I look forward to S, T, is also quite a big one. S is a very big one. Eh? The fourth and last surprise was a meeting with F.W. de Klerk at his foundation last year and in Cape Town. They'd never invited me. F.W. de Klerk didn't like me very much. We would meet at conferences, and he'd be correct, but not warm. I got on wonderfully well with Rolf Meyer. I mean, he's an extraordinary person, with Leon Wessels. Interestingly enough, the third person who played a very big role, if I gave you 20 questions you wouldn't get in the negotiations, was David de Villiers, the former Springbok rugby captain. He was terrific at chairing meetings, at finding solutions, just a different approach. Others would come in, snarl, shout, make speeches, march out. They got nothing. They defended nothing for the Afrikaans people. The people working slowly and calmly in a principled way, negotiating, got very significant accommodations. I wouldn't call them compromises, accommodations, on the basis of hard negotiation. In any event, FW, I was told, fought bitterly against my being appointed to the Constitutional Court in Cabinet. And now I'm going to, at some anniversary of his foundation, I arrive there. He greets me very correctly, a little smile. His wife is wonderful. She embraces me. She's warm. Oh, it's so nice to have you here, and so on. And I make my presentation. And it's on multiculturalism in the new South Africa. And the basic theme that I advance is that if you did a paternity test on the South African Constitution, I ask whose DNA would come up, and very few South Africans get the answer. And the answer is Oliver Tambo. Oliver Tambo. And it was really the question of group rights versus non-racial democracy. Would minorities be protected by group rights? And the answer is it would have been a disaster. The Constitution would have been seen as a constitution protecting minorities who had all the privileges, not as a constitution for everybody. And Oliver Tambo said, no, our protection must be through a Bill of Rights that protects everybody, not because you're white or black or majority or minority, but because you are a human being. We've just got to get used to thinking of ourselves as human beings. That means majority rule in South Africa. That means black people basically will rule, but not on the basis that they rule as blacks. They're ruling as the majority, as human beings. And people are protected against abuse, whatever form it might take, from whomever it might come, because they are human beings, and we implanted that in. Now, where does that leave multiculturalism? Multiculturalism then didn't become the basis of our political structures. We would have had, if we'd followed what de Klerk and the others were saying, we would have had three presidents, Mandela on Monday, de Klerk on Tuesday, Buthelezi on Wednesday. I'm exaggerating, it would have been 6 months for each. And they would have to agree and get consensus on everything for governing. Can you imagine? There would have been paralysis. And people would have been identifying completely with their racial ethnic group, and our country couldn't have moved forward. But the minute multiculturalism is seen as multiculturalism and not multinationalism for politics, then the diversity of our nation becomes very, very important. And then I mentioned, I grew up, the first painter I knew was Gregoire Bonsaia. And he would, fortunately, the first artistic person I knew was full of fun, laughter. He would pack his paintings in the dicky seat of his old chef and drive out to the countryside and tell the farmers, a house without a picture is a house without a soul. And since he was the only one who had a picture, he would sell his pictures that way. And the first poet I met was Ace Kricher, who actually had a huge influence on my life through a lecture that he gave on Lorca, which captured my imagination so much, Lorca and Neruda, involving the intimacy of your soul, of your longing with the public events of the world. That's when I became politically active, through Ace Kricher. I was also friendly with Die Sestigers, Jan Rabbi, Marjorie Wallace did a portrait of me. I met Jan and I met André Brunk and other people of that group who were very kind to me in a very difficult time when I was in and out of jail. They received me and embraced me. And I'm saying also, my dad was the general secretary of the Garment Workers Union in Johannesburg. And I would go up for holidays to be with him. And there was Anna Skippers and Hester Cornelius seemed enormous, and Johanna Cornelius. And these were Afrikaans women. And my dad's book about the garment workers was called Rebels' Daughters, the daughters of the rebels who now were forced to work in the sweatshops, in the garment factories, exploited, and he helped to organize them. And they were wonderful to me and my brother, and gracious. So for me, Afrikaners were not Dur people, hostile and dominating. They were people full of energy and brightness. And so that colored to quite a large extent my view and vision, understanding of the Afrikaans language. I mentioned a few other things. My lecture is over. I'm walking out, and de Klerk is standing in my way. En hy praat vir my in Afrikaans. And he's blocking my way, and he says, his father was a school principal in Klerksdorp, a very good school principal, he said, but the Nationalist Party took him out of school to get him to be involved in trade union activity to try and destroy the Garment Workers Union run by Solly Sachs. His father, Jan de Klerk, went on to become the Minister of Labour, who passed many laws that denied black people the right to organise trade unions, laws which de Klerk said he, de Klerk, had since repealed. He smiles, he puts out his hand, shakes my hand, and I leave. And I'm moved by that gesture on his part. And I think to myself, only in South Africa do you have these kinds of meetings, another generation now having an encounter of that side. Okay, four surprises. I think I get 4 out of 4. Let me then just finish with the case. Ismail Mahomet wrote the judgment for the court. The text of our constitution was very clear. You could have a single medium school if you paid for it. But in the state sector, it understood there was no right to have a single medium school, which meant Parliament or the provincial legislature could pass that law. He felt it was very simple. I felt that wasn't a good enough answer. The people who were arguing, the advocates, they were almost crying. It was as if the future of the nation depended upon the skill of the argument. And I remembered the days when I used to argue as an advocate, where I would feel so much depended on me, that weight was terrible. If I mess up, my client, our struggle, our people, our rights are going to be lost. I felt they were entitled to an answer that went beyond simply the technical thing in the Constitution. And really what they were claiming was a form of group rights in the cultural sphere. Our Constitution, in a sense, is every person, and it looks very individualistic. But some rights can only be exercised in communities. Language rights. If you speak just to yourself, people send you to hospital. There's something wrong. So language rights depend on a community. Many cultural rights depend on having a community. And there's a growing move in international law to say that the state has a duty to defend and protect and develop minority languages. And these are usually for minority groups that have been marginalized, the Roma and others. And we had to deal with that. We had to engage with those issues. And in South Africa, in London, I'd gone to the minority rights group who were giving the anti-apartheid struggle a lot of support, but thinking there's a puzzle here. Because in South Africa, the minority are not oppressed. The minority are the oppressors. So in South Africa, the minority behave like a majority and treat the majority as a minority in terms of access to power, to rights, to where you can live, what you can do. And we had to understand minority rights as being so involved with minority privileges that simply to protect minority rights could be protecting the gains of domination, the gains of exclusion. At the same time, a privileged minority could be converted into, through retaliation, into a dispossessed minority. So it wasn't a simple question of simply turning the tables. And I felt it was appropriate to give an answer that engaged with those broader issues. The pieces of paper that we circulated have themes from my judgment there that indicate that we have to look at this issue. A, Afrikaans is not just a language, it's one of the treasures of South Africa for all our people. And it's produced a great literature, it's been used in science for poetry. It's the language spoken by millions of people, it's the majority language in the Western Cape. It's part and parcel of the fabric of the nation, and it needs to be treasured. It's not just being nice to somebody, it's valuing and appreciating a treasure. Secondly, people who spoke Afrikaans have a deep memory of the Milne period and the suppression of Afrikaans and the marginalization of Afrikaans speakers. And they see English in that sense as the enemy. English will overwhelm, English will dominate, English will exclude. And we have to understand that because that was a deliberate policy of the British at the time of empire to suppress and marginalize Afrikaans, destroy the power of Afrikaners and make Afrikaners feel somehow they lived in the backyard. And that's part of our history that we need to understand. And that's a fear that's not simply based on the wish to dominate. It's a wish not to be dominated. At the same time, there are millions of black children aching for education. They've been excluded, they've been denied. And the schools now, these schools were half empty. The evidence was maybe two-thirds full, empty classrooms. And here were black kids in the neighborhood, and sometimes the children of domestic workers in those areas, clamoring to get to those schools. And we said there are children's rights. The right to education, the text of the Constitution. So we had to uphold the constitutionality of that particular measure. That's how we resolved that problem. But it's interesting, the problem was resolved in terms of what the Constitution permitted, but the problems don't go away simply because you find a solution to a particular issue at a particular moment. And it's quite clear that Stellenbosch University at this moment is grappling with very, very similar issues. And I look forward to your engagement and anything you can teach me in relation to that. And I might say there's some talks that one gives. I always enjoy talking. I acknowledge I love hearing the sound of my own voice. But there's some moments that I get a special pleasure, and this is one of them, because it's at Stellenbosch, because in a way this was the land of the enemy, the ideological enemy. Dr. Verwoerd had been a professor here, and I don't feel I'm a conqueror coming in now. When Thabo Mbeki went to the University of Pretoria in the early 1990s, to speak to the Center for Human Rights, and this big hubbub coming from there, and Avi Beer was very strong. He said, "Now I know how Pieter Retief felt when he went into Dingane's kraal." I don't feel anything like that. I just feel South Africa, we are moving. We are opening up. I can feel comfortable here. I don't feel I'm Pieter Retief entering a kind of a kraal. Most of you are Afrikaans speakers, most of you are from an older generation. But I feel ons is landgenote, I really feel it. And so I want to thank you, Van die Veers, for inviting me to be here, and I look forward to the discussion. Dankie.
Well, the honor is, we feel very honored to have you here. Okay. Ons voel baie geëerd dat u hier is. En ek gebruik die u woord feitelijk nooit nie, maar ek voel, dit is nou gepas. Ja, ek wil graag hê dat ons gesprek moet hê, want ons het een geleentheid om vir iemand wat waarschijnlijk op 'n regstegniese en op 'n holistiese manier na hierdie saak van Afrikaans gekyk het, op 'n manier wat nie noodwendig vir ons as eerste taalsprekers moontlik is nie, omdat taal so emosioneel gelaai is. En ek dink in die Afrikaanse konteks, in 'n groepering wat hoofsaaklik wit en bruin is, is die dinamiek van taal so verskillend dat ons nog nie eers behoorlik met mekaar kan praat nie, en dat daar nie eers behoorlike begrip vir mekaar se taalidentiteite is nie. Dit was vir my baie interessant dat jy verwys het na die other side. Ek weet nie of jy bewus is nie, maar ons het Mercy Kannemeyer, wat hier reg voor sit, het onlangs 'n video gemaak oor wat sy genoem het die ander kant, spesifiek oor die taal en taalkwessie op Stellenbosch, en dan 'n perspektief uit 'n jong dynamiese brein studentse oogpunt, 'n vroulike studentse oogpunt, want ek het onlangs vir iemand anders in die gehoor gevra, kan 'n taalstryd gewen word? Uit my oortuig, dit kan gewen word, maar hierdie gaan nie oor wen en verloor nie, dit gaan oor kompromie, dit gaan oor begrip. So, kom ons begin, waar begin ons? Ons sit op 'n manier in 'n skaakmat situasie. Die enigste, ons wend ons tot 'n hof om taalregte te beskerm, en daar is geen wenners nie. Dit is net groot regsrekeninge. Wat ons kan die geld baie beter benut. Ons kan in 'n onderwysomgewing daai geld ongelooflik beter benut. So kom ons kyk, wat wil julle, waar ons die gesprek se onderwerp is, waar is Afrikaans oor 20 jaar? Waar gaan dit wees? Teens Elof sê dis uitgesterf binne die volgende 8 jaar as universiteitstaal. So is hy reg? Is hy akkuraat? Ja, kom ons kry so 4 of 5 opmerkings en vrae.
So wat ek gesê het is dat ons hier voor kom uit 'n multirassige, multikulturele skoolstelsel en bestel. Dit is gewoond aan 'n reënboognasie. Jy weet, jy het identiteit en met ander het ook identiteit. Ons land se lees is eenheid en diversiteit. Maar nou die probleem kom, is wat gebeur as jy die drama agtergrond of redenaars agtergrond hele. Nou, wag nou, het jy nou vir my punt afgegooi? So jy het jou identiteit, jy weet ander mense identiteit, maar nou die probleem kom wanneer daar jou identiteit misken word, of weet dit kom in gedrang, jy kry etiket as jy praat Afrikaans, of as Afriforum nou weer iets gesê het wat sin maak, of die pot al reg maak, dan sit nou 'n probleem en dan sien nou weer wat regs. Nou, daar is ook so 'n ander ding, transformative constitutionalism, dat ons grondwet is, jy weet, van waar ons is na waar ons wil wees. Nou, baie mooi, daar was hierdie honeymoon phase, en toe vir my hierdie tussen 30 en 40 jarige jong docente, of wat nou op campus is, of in die werksmag betree, verontskuldig hulle self en sê, ja, maar hulle ken die honeymoon phase, en hulle weet nie eintlik van aktivisme nie, maar dit help my nie, want ons begin nou weer met al hierdie dinamikas, verstaan jy, dis nie okay om Afrikaans, dis nie okay om wit te wees, maar soms is dit okay, jy weet, jy het hierdie verdeeldheid, ons bruin Afrikaans, ons swart Afrikaans, ons wit Afrikaans, dis nie net Afrikaans nie. En oor 20 jaar sal hierdie uitsluiting, jy weet, ons sal iets daaraan moet doen, maar voordat jy iets daaraan kan doen, sal ons moet praat oor die probleme van Afrikaans. En soos Dr. Titus nou gesê het, dit moet deel word van 'n nasionale diskurs. Mense is dankbaar vir die Vriende van Afrikaans wat gespreksreeks het, waar jy kan praat, maar die olifant bly nog steeds nie vertrek. So kom ons sê daaroor, mense het pyn, en waar kom hierdie pyn vandaan? Dit sit in jou DNA. Dit kom uit 'n generasie wat nie 'n stem gehad het nie. En ons is die eerste generasie, my generasie, die millennials, die tweede groep millennials, nie die 1980 millennials nie, wel is 'n bietjie anderste, en van die 1990 groep af millennials. Wat het jy gesê? Die stem, ja, wat na vore kom, en verstaan, ons sit daar met mekaar, maar in die pyn, dis die pyn van jou DNA sit, pyn van die vorige generasie, hoe hanteer jy dit, wat maak jy daarmee, wat maak jy, moet jy deel wees van kollektiewe skuld, omdat jy wit is, iets wat my pa en ouers en oupa was nie deel van die boerebond nie, ja, ek het seker white privilege, en ek was wit, maar my ma moes hulle basse afwerk, om hulle beurs en goed terug te betaal, maar ander mense is meer bevoordeel, en toe vir my dikwels, dat hierdie mense wat so bevoordeel is, is nou juist die mense wat die grootste teenkanting bied hier Afrikaans. En nog een ding, ek hoor die woord Afrikaner, nie haat nie, nie, excuse, die woord Afrikaner is gelaai, ons is Afrikaans sprekende Afrikaner. En daai dinamika verstaan mense nie, jy weet, dit is so moeilik as jy pro-Afrikaans, dit beteken dan jy is anti-Engels, is jy anti-Afrikaans wees, en pro-transformatie wees, of is dit, en dan wat is transformatie? So, die eerste ding is, as ons wil praat oor die toekoms van Afrikaans, moet ons eers kyk na die probleme. Ons kort 'n nasionale diskurs, dalk gaan dit op die einde weer uitloop en ons is in 'n komplekse stelsel op 'n tweede waarheids- en versoeningskommissie. Ek weet nie. Maar daar word nie genoeg gepraat nie. Ek verstaan nie jou pyn altyd nie, Mercy, en ek weet nie of jy verstaan of ek ook pyn het nie. So, ja, dan voordat ons praat oor die toekoms van Afrikaans, eers praat oor die probleme, en dan hierdie probleme, dis nie bedreigings, dit kan 'n geleentheid word. Ek dink so aan sin my uit die woordeboek van Afrikaanse taal, wat bevoordeel is in apartheid, dat ja, vir Afrikaanse taal woordeboek wees moet vasgevang word, maar hulle lei die ander 10 woordeboek eenhede op, verstaan, dis nie dat hulle net op hulle eie aangaan, en dan nog 'n ding ook, sodra 'n nuwe, daar's daar maar online WOT ook, so as daar nou 'n nuwe woord kom, dan word dit daarom vrygestel op die online WOT, so word A en B en C en D en E en F daarom ook bygewerk. Ok, so my punt is net, ek dink ons het praat oor die probleme, maar die probleme moet geleenthede wees wat Afrikaans voortoe kan neem. So, waar is ons nou en waar wil ons uitkom? Want het voel vir my, daar is nie, ons werk nie na het doel toe nie, het voel vir my, dis 'n nationale probleem, want jy weet, allemaal het hy regte, dis demokrasie, dis wonderlik, is prachtig, maar bring dit vir jou kos op die tafel, gaan dit vir jou werk, weet, allemaal het hy vir regte, maar dit waarborg nie 'n plek in universiteit nie. En dan gaan ons eens nog gaan praat oor onderrigtaal nie, maar so wat ek sê is, kom ons praat oor die probleme, om skep het 'n geleenthede en besluit waarheen wil ons gaan met Afrikaans en ook dan sommer met die land.
Ek gaan nog 3 sprekers toelaat en dan gaan ons eers reflekteer, maar ek vra mooi dat julle dit kort sal hou en dat julle net seker maak dat julle hoofpunt wel duidelik gekommunikeer word. Begin miskien daarmee. Want dit is moeilik om, die lokale klank is ook problematies vir ou oor soos myne, so ons sukkel om ordentlik te hoor wat mense sê. Ok, Dani, dan professor Grindling en dan hierdie jong, julle moet maar besluit wat die een van die jong mense. En ek dink, sê ook julle naam, want allemaal ken mekaar nie, dat mense weet na wie ons luister.
Saartjie, ek gaan dit probeer kort hou, soos jy gevra het. Op die ou end, dink ek, staan of val hierdie hele storie. As ons al praat oor Afrikaans oor 20 jaar, by die politieke wil om meertaligheid werklik moontlik te maak. Ek wil graag begin deur te verwys na wat regter Sacks ook gesê het, na die uitspraak van Samora Machel wat gesê het, in order for the nation to live, the tribe must die. My eerste vraag is, of hoewel ons baie mooi gebare aan meertaligheid in die grondwet het, of dit nie eintlik nog steeds die ware instelling is, miskien aan regeringskant nie. En die tweede ding wat ek wil sê, wat daarby aansluit, is daai spesifieke uitspraak van Michelle het ter sprake gekom verlede jaar in maart, by 'n vergadering van die Translation Linguistic Rights Committee van PEN International, waar baie PEN Afrika sentrums teenwoordig was. Zambia, Daniel Seekersway van PEN Zambia het geopper, Uganda was daar, Kenya, Malawi, Zimbabwe ensovoorts. En die consensus was van allemaal dat die koloniale tale Afrika klaaglik gevaarlik. Die koloniale tale Engels, Frans en Arabies bewerkstellig slegs toegang vir 'n sekere klein elite wat dan die reg het om menslike hulpbronne of natuurlike hulpbronne te verkoop aan die hoogste beer uit die ooste of die weste. Met ander woorde, die consensus was daar dat moedertaalonderrig die enigste pad vorentoe is vir Afrika om die grootste dele van sy bevolking te bemagtig. Maar die consensus was ook dat die politieke wil van die noorde in Afrika tot die suide van Afrika ontbreek. Tadi Epiola van Nigeria het opgestaan en gesê hy is Yoruba. Yoruba het 20 miljoen sprekers. Die grootste werke van letterkunde in Yoruba is nie beskikbaar in Nigeria. Nigeria het slegs in die 70s, toe daar bietjie oliegeld was, erns gemaak met moedertaalonderrig. En daar was groot sukses daarmee, maar dit is nie voortgesit nie. Met ander woorde, die vraag by my is, en dit gaan ook oor of 'n taalstryd gewen kan word of nie. Wat my betref, kan 'n taalstryd slegs gewen word, soos in Quebec of in Katalonië, of nou onlangs die geval met die Wallisers, as daar 'n politieke wil is om ruimtes te skep vir daardie taal om te oorleef en te gedei. En dit beteken nie dat mens daarmee die leefruimte van ander tale wil wegneem nie, maar ek wonder of die politieke wil daar is om daardie ruimte te skep aan 'n tersiêre staatsinstelling in Suid-Afrika, want ek sien dit nie op die oomblik nie.
Okay. Mercy? Of nie, wie is die professor Grindling? Laat professor Grindling, kan ons net gauw vir hom.
Thank you, I'll be very brief. I'd just like to ask the good judge, and it connects with what Donnie has said as well, And that is, why does he think it's so difficult to establish multilingual or bilingual even universities in South Africa? We had them before, University of Port Elizabeth and the University of South Africa, where I misspent most of my life. But I think that's an important point, and it probably relates to what he mentioned, the issue of political will. You're an expert in cultural, legal, and political matters. Perhaps you can enlighten us on that. Thank you.
Okay, daar was, kan ons nog, kom ons maak nou nog drie. Hier is 'n vraag hier. Hier so. Mercy. Is, okay, so, wie is nou nummer 1? Ja. Okay.
Baie dankie. Dis net vir regte saks, ek het nou spesifiek na paragraaf 52 gekyk van die, of, van die uitspraak, en daar is nogal 'n besondere klem op gelykheid geleë, wat sê spesifiek, at present the imperatives of equalizing access to education are strong, and even although these should not go to the extent of overriding constitutionally protected rights in relation to language and culture, they do represent an important element in the equation. En my vraag is eenvoudig, maar net, how can we balance this right to language, if I may call it rudimentarily so, with the socio-economic and substantive rights in the constitution, die substantieve regte wat beoog om 'n meer gelyke materiële samelewing te beweeg te bring.
So, kan ek net gou vra, ek het 'n ander dokument hier, dis nie dieselfde as julle sinne nie, dat ek net gou dat hy net dat regter Sachs net kan sien waarna jy verwys.
Goed, dis paragraaf 52 van die hofuitspraak. Ek sal hom hier aanstuur as dit reg is.
Ek is ingeboortes, ek is 'n Afrikaans-Nederlandse letterkundestudent aan die Universiteit van Kaapstad, maar ek is oorspronklik van die Vrystaat. En ek glo Afrikaans in die Vrystaat lyk baie anders as die Afrikaans wat ek hier in die Weskaap sien. Ons in die Vrystaat ondervind ons maar nog 'n baie wit en 'n baie konservatiewe Afrikaans. Teenoor hier in die Kaap ondervind ek, jy neem inteendeel by 'n universiteit soos Kaapstad, is dit 'n baie liberale stand eintlik om Afrikaans te ondersteun, want dit maak jou pro-inheemse tale. En ek het op 'n stadium 'n interessante ervaring gehad, op dieselfde stadium wat die Universiteit van die Vrystaat besig was om 'n uitspraak te lewer dat Afrikaans uitgefraseer gaan word as 'n onderrigtaal, was die Universiteit van Kaapstad besig om 'n gesprek te hê, hoe sal ons Afrikaans meer insluit in ons syllabus, so ook met die ander inheemse tale. My vraag sal dan wees, is Afrikaans een taal, wanneer ons so baie kulture het, en mag ons dieselfde uitsprake maak oor Weskaapse Afrikaans as oor Afrikaans in ander provinsies? En dan wil ek bylas, ek het onlangs 'n gesprek bygewoon in Wellington van Breiten Breitenbach en Andries Besidenhout, en daar was 'n opmerking wat daar gemaak is, wat ek gedink het, miskien oorgedra kan word na vandag, is, hoe gaan ons te werk met hierdie broederskap, geesgenootskap tussen brein en wit Afrikaans sprekende mense, Afrikaanse Afrikane, wanneer ons kan sien, ons is nog steeds in so 'n eksklusiewe taal, wat doen ons met ons swart broers?
Okay, ons moet sien, dan gaan ek vir regter Sachs kans gee om te reageer, en dan gaan ons ongelukkig moet halt roep. Ek kan my regte as direkteur 'n bietjie misbruik om hierdie gesprek te laat aangaan, want ek dink dit is belangrike goed wat gesê word, en ek dink ons het nog nie naaste by die kern van die saak uitgekom nie. So Missie, kom ons gee vir jou die laaste woord en dan gee ons oor aan regter Sachs.
Dankie. Hallo, ek is Missie Kannemeyer, en ek wil oor die vraag oor waar Afrikaans oor 20 jaar is, dink ek, as dit is reg, almal hoor. Okay, dink ek dat ja, Afrikaans gaan oorleef, want ons sien hoe daar 'n opname is in goeders soos theater, in Afrikaanse movies, in die boeke, goeders wat gepubliseer word. So ja, Afrikaans gaan oorleef, mits ons daai goeders oopmaak vir almal. Want movies en theater en sulke goeders is grootliks ontoeganklik baie kere vir baie Afrikaans sprekende mense. En dan wil ek saamstem met Dr. Titus, dat ek sal baie graag wil sien dat baie meer sprekers van die taal verteenwoordig word binne Afrikaans. Ek stem saam met Daan oor moedertaalonderrig, dat dit regtig belangrik is. En dan dink ek ook nie dat een jong mens vir almal kan praat nie. Want ons kom almal uit ons verskillende agtergronde, ons almal soos het verskillende pyn, verskillende uitdagings. So ek dink regtig ons moet ook plek maak dat alle jong mense uit hulle eie ervaring kan praat. Maar ja, ek dink definitief, maar 20 jaar Afrikaans is definitief nog hierso.
Okay. Ons het regtig te min tyd om nou breedvoerig by elke opmerking en vraag stil te staan. So Elbie, jy kan gesels oor wat jy dink belangrik is. Waarmee laat jy ons, want ek dink mense wil graag woorde van hoop hoor.
Okay, then just general thoughts that surge up from inside. First of all, I just want to say, Mercy, I'm so proud to be in the room with you. And I haven't seen your film, but it made a terrific impact. And you were speaking in your voice. And the fact that it had such an impact was your voice resonated. It's significant. And that's part of the debate, to have all the voices and people speaking out from their experience. And you speak of somebody who's baie machtig in Afrikaans. I think you think in Afrikaans a lot. Maybe you even swear in Afrikaans. The point that was made by another speaker, I deliberately used the word Creole in the judgment. And it was partly because white Afrikaners were frightened of what they called miscegenation. They were terrified of mixing, of commingling. So they even had a law that prevented white people from kissing and loving black people, and black people from kissing and loving white people. And that idea of purity was seen as foundational and fundamental. And we have to retain our purity as whites in Africa. And it was all based on lies. The Afrikaners themselves, Van der Stel, Stellenbosch, the Van der Stel's wife was a black woman. And Van der Stel himself was somebody, by all accounts for those times, was more far-sighted, more welcoming, more open, and his son was the one who began that line of authoritarianism associated with the white skin and so on. And the Afrikaans language, this is what I learned actually from Jan Rabie and others, is a Creole language. It's the language, it was called Kitchen Dutch, because the Hoog Hollands, the real Netherlands, was spoken in the church and the schools, and that meant you were civilized. But meanwhile, the slaves who had been deprived of their languages, of their names, of their languages, had to get by. So they simplified and they softened Afrikaans, and they made it more expressive and more rooted, not in the cold climes of Northern Europe, but in the warm climate of Southern Africa, with our soil and our texture and our people. And many Khoi words were introduced. Aina is Aina, you can't get anything like it. A pisang is a pisang, that's a Malay word. All these words came in, that I learned from Jan and Andre and the others at that stage. And the reason why it was so vital was it was close to the people. So the slaves were the creators of Afrikaans. They Africanized Netherlands. And that then became, because the children were learning that language, they expressed themselves in that language, more and more Netherlands, which was officially recognized in the constitution, became out of touch. And then, of course, Afrikaans was officialized. Now, I spoke about my also pride in Andivat, the Afrikaans Woordenboek. But it's a pride, it's not unmixed pride. The very idea of formalizing a language in a way is a contradiction. And it's establishing an authentic, correct way. I don't think it has a speaking version yet. Maybe that will come next. So even the pronunciation might be a correct pronunciation. And of course, Afrikaans is spoken with different accents. It's not only the Free State Afrikaans is different in many ways from the Western Cape Afrikaans. In the Western Cape, it's very different. And my wife speaks Afrikaans. She grew up speaking Afrikaans on the flats. And even the way she speaks it differs depending on who she's speaking to, the context, the emotions, and that's me part of its vitality and its strength, and part of its survival. If it's going to be a fossilized, authentic, authorized language associated with authority and power, it's going to lose out. If it's going to be a language that is expressive and responsive, and it will survive not because of protections, not because of law, but because it's meaningful to people. And I know that many, many forward-looking Afrikaners see its strength comes from the fact that Afrikaans is a powerful language in the home, in the church, but in business, in commerce, in daily life. That's its strength and its vitality. And the vitality won't come from formal protections. That's not to say that it's not important to have public places where Afrikaans has a guaranteed space and a presence. I have never been responsible for language policy. We've discussed it on the court. We found it extremely difficult. We couldn't come to an agreement as to what the language policy of the courts should be to formalize it, because any rule that you had would have huge positive results in some areas, but if it was made too imperious, would be negative elsewhere. So you might have a trial being conducted in Umtata, where the prosecutor speaks Xhosa, the accused understand Xhosa, the witnesses speak Xhosa, but you'll have an English version of it, because it's going to go on appeal and other appeal, and you need some kind of language that everybody can handle. And until we have appeal court judges who can speak 11 languages, there has to be maybe some kind of adaptation. I don't even know what the answer is. We ended up, lawyers don't like to say we don't know what the answer is, but yeah, it wasn't a legal case brought before us, it was a policy issue, and we just sort of left it open. So the theme for me then is Afrikaans will not only survive, it will thrive, primarily because it's a very meaningful, it's more than just a means of communication, form of expression. It's interesting, you know, even in the years of exile, when you met another exile, you would go into Afrikaans. Sometimes it will be even a Skolitaal or a Tsotsitaal, but somehow the Afrikaans was a form of patriotism, of identification, because it wasn't English. It wasn't part of the empire. That was ons. And Afrikaans has got it, the wortels. Those are the strong roots that are very, very meaningful. The problem always is its association with authority, power, apartheid, domination, and exclusiveness. And somebody mentioned a feeling of guilt. I've never found guilt a useful emotion or shame. Understanding, appreciation, acknowledgement is much more powerful. Guilt, I don't know, it eats you up. Shame eats you up. You want pride in who you are, what you do, but a pride that comes not from being associated with exclusion of others and domination, but pride, if you're looking for role models, I mean, Bram Fischer was one of my super heroes. And he was very much an Afrikaner. And I can't explain exactly why, but you knew it when you saw it. He spoke beautiful English, but there was something, and from the Free State, the speaker there would be happy to know, Beyers Nodi was somebody who came onto the scene after I went into exile. Umbay, he was so loved. And amongst young black African people, he helped the resistance, he helped the underground. He didn't cease to be a Boer and Afrikaner the way he was, but his soul and his spirit was so welcoming and so on. So I don't think the theme of shame, the language never feels shame and should never feel shame, just as German was used by Hitler, but German is a beautiful poetic language and was the language of Karl Marx and revolutionaries and Habermas and many others. So it's not the language that should be rejected. It's the way the language was used. And I think the language will revitalize itself. I think even if it's simply out of self-interest, the white Afrikaners who see themselves as white Afrikaners, even out of simple self-interest, have got to see that the language belongs equally and even more to black and brown Afrikaners. and welcome that and embrace that, not simply to get votes and support, but to distance themselves from that assumption that we were in charge, we know best, we have some kind of God-given authority to rule and to be in charge, we're being dislodged from that and we must fight back. That kind of psychology will be very, very destructive, but not only destructive in terms of political comfort, destructive internally, because it's limiting the foundations, it's producing the foundations, it's regret, it's loss, it's longing for a day that's never going to come back. I don't think that's the way forward. The way forward is to be proud of the richness of the language, the vitality of the language, to embrace the Creole quality of it, both Afrikaans as a language and the way it's spoken by all the different people, the Namaqua, the people of different parts of the country, and even here in the Western Cape. So I feel myself a little bit liberated having come here. I've enjoyed the discourse. I appreciate the fact that people haven't been shouting today. I belong to a generation. We were very firm. We were willing to give our lives. We didn't shout. We didn't find it necessary to have a rugby match in Parliament to make our points. And I'll always be like that. But people say we've been quiet for too long. We don't get anywhere unless we actually shout, unless we do something dramatic, nobody pays attention to us. I have to listen to that. But I don't think that's going to be the way to defend Afrikaans. I don't think that's going to be the way to advance Afrikaans. Baie dankie, almal.